This is John Newman, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 11th of April 2011. John Newman, Part 2.
We were talking during the break about craftsmanship and precision and skill in metalwork and so on. I'm just wondering whether there's actually the Antarctic as a place for perfection, or whether you can get away with an awful lot of bodging.
Oh, of course you can get away with an awful lot of bodging.
But you have a view on that, don't you?
I would always try to make a repair or a replacement or something of that nature. If I didn't have the part, I would try to make something. And that thing that I made, I would try to arrange it so that it didn't need to be replaced by the genuine part. I could make something which was equally as serviceable as the genuine part. There's other people I know think the same way. They can do the same.
Can you think of an example where you had to be inventive to effect a repair because you hadn't got what you needed?
Oh, my goodness. That's happened lots of times, but I can't put my finger on one at the moment.
Were you ever stumped?
No. No, I always got out of it. Always got out of it some way or another. I was never actually stumped by a problem.
And was that largely because of the apprenticeship you did at the MOD? Was that the grounding of your future Fidge career as a technical mechanical man?
Yes, in part, in great part. But also, I never threw anything away. I could see the use for in the future use, possible use, in what ordinary people would consider junk, and I used to keep hold of it because down in the Antarctic, you can't nip round the corner shop and get a strip of steel or chunk of brass or something. So I used to hoard all these bits and pieces for a rainy day, and sure enough, they came in handy. I'm sure people that followed me threw all this stuff out. But there you are. They did it their way and I did it mine.
We left you having come back to Britain after your sojourn down south, and you went back into your father's garage business for a while.
Yeah, just for a while, yeah.
But what happened next?
I got the great feeling of unfinished business down south. And in conversation with people like Steve Wormald and the other people that I'd wintered with, most of us felt the same. So I think we all reapplied.
Some en masse or...?
No, not en masse, but I think we generally reapplied and learnt that somebody else was reapplying after we'd done it. And we seemed to reform very much a similar team. And carried on.
What did you mean by unfinished business?
I don't know. Probably there was a better way of, slightly better way of doing things. A slightly more could be achieved by a concerted effort in that year. We all gave it a good shot, and I think we probably did quite a good job, not blowing our own trumpet or anything. But
did you have to reapply, or did you just ring up Bass and say, I'd like to go again?
I said I'd like to go again. And they said, oh, of course, we'll have to stand against all the other applicants and the rest of it. About a week later, you know.
So where were you this time? Back at Stonington?
Yes, back to Stonington, yeah.
Which was coming towards the end of its life, wasn't it?
Very much, yeah, the end of its life.
How did that feel? Because he was the famous base of British Antarctic period, and suddenly it was being wound down.
Yeah, it was the famous travelling base. That and Hope Bay were famous dog travelling bases. It was obvious, really, that it was coming to the end of an era, really.
Why was it obvious?
You just felt that way. It felt as if we were coming to the end of a an era.
Was the work running out? Or
no, I don't think the work was running out, but of course the work was further and further and further away. In the summer, people travelled, I guess, you know, 500 miles. No, not 500 miles. 200 miles, let's say, to get to their work area. And they'd start in spring and travel with dog team. With the advent of reliable air operations, people could be dropped in for the summer and taken out at the end of it. They didn't need to winter. Mm. All the scientists wintered in those days. So they could write up in the northern summer and do the work in the southern summer. Speeded everything up.
So knowing the base was on its last legs, how did that influence the way you went about doing what you did? Because there was nothing to build, there was no sort of long-term future for your mechanical devices.
I wouldn't say we knew it was on its last legs. I think we recognised that some probably far-reaching change was in the air, especially as a director had obviously changed at that time. Sir Vivian Fuchs had retired, and Dick Laws had taken over. Completely different viewpoint, sort of more modern viewpoint, and change was inevitable. We didn't know quite what the change was going to be. It was going to be, as far as we could see, probably bad for Stonington, but there was no confirmation of that.
Who was with you for that winter?
Steve Roman was base commander.
Tony Gannon?
Tony Gannon was there, yes. He was in there to do complete a bunk room rearrangement that was going on, because previously we'd slept 17 or 18 people in what was essentially a large room, and the only divisions were the bunks themselves, and it was a bit squalid, to say the least. And there was an extension on the end for a food store with bunk rooms above, and the old bunk rooms were made into individual twin bunk room areas. A bit civilised, actually.
So what were you doing whilst that winter was on? Was it servicing the equipment again?
Yes, yeah. Engines, pups, chasing after aeroplanes on runway. Generally, I did quite a lot of maintenance as well to bits and pieces.
Was doing a third winter okay, or was it a bit what's the word I'm looking for? Having done two already, was it losing its appeal a bit?
No. No, it was the most enjoyable one, actually. It was the most enjoyable winter.
Why was that?
I think the crew that we had down there were all, to a large extent, experienced. We'd been down before, not all at the same place. And it's one of those things where everybody comes together for a unified purpose. It just worked, and it worked very well.
There was a kind of an overarching scheme to start clearing up the Stonington base area, wasn't there, because of the potential pullout? And
I don't know about the pullout, but I think Bass was getting sensitive about some of the condition of some of its old base sites. Some of them were pretty squalid, you know, food dumps and the rest of it just mouldering away, and pens and dog pens and things all over the place, huts falling to pieces. There was a realisation, I think, that these places had to be maintained. Well, the original base at Stonington, next to the American base, which was also on the island, was probably one of the most historic buildings in the British Antarctic sector. Was largely derelict. No windows, roof badly damaged, etc. people had treated it as a convenient place to chuck junk. You know, if they were tidying up the island for bits of packing case or whatever, if they were near the building, it would go through the window and be taken care of. And the whole place was dreadful. I think, I don't know if there was a specific instruction from Cambridge or wherever to clean that base up, but the previous year to my third year, it was set on fire to clean it up, and it burnt very well, I believe. But the trouble was, the building was 3 feet deep in ice, and the fire stopped at 3 feet, and left everything inside and outside at 3 feet. So we were left with a bit of a worse problem than a slightly derelict building.
How did you deal with it?
Oh, we treated it all. Ash. Fire ash. We sprinkled fire ash on the top of it, which, with the sunlight, melted down. Occasional sprinkle of cocoa, which has the same effect. Cocoa is wonderful for melting ice. Gradually worked away at it and reduced the ice inside until we got to the floor and cleared everything. Cleared the stub walls, cleared the SE range cooker that was encased in ice in there. Great big, like a cast iron arga, same beast. That was in there solid. That was all taken away. Unfortunately, at that time, we didn't have a coherent environmental policy, and all this stuff was put on a raft and taken out into the bay and chucked into the sea, which is, on the face of it, you wouldn't dream of doing that now. You'd have to case it all up and drum it all up and ship it out. But we got rid of it. We got rid of it out of sight.
What's your view on that? Because I wonder whether you fully approve of the idea of taking everything back to the UK again, or shipping everything out of the Antarctic when it's been finished with?
Within reason, I would say ship it out. But opinions vary. I mean, when they were cleaning up Fossil Bluff, there were, I think, big mistakes made. In that they started, there was a muskeg there. There was a muskeg at Fossil Bluff. It had driven there over the sea ice from Adelaide, actually came from Stonington out the fjord and down the sea ice through in Margaret Bay. The previous year, there were two muskegs there. They sent two muskegs from Stonington. One had gone through the sea ice and one had made it. And they sent another one down. And one was running down there and parked up happily. And yet the people who went down there to clear the place up, because it was a dreadful mess. There was drums and drums and drums of waste tipped into the ice of the sound, tipped into the tide crack of the sound. And they had to dig it up. But they started taking this muskeg apart. Now, from my point of view, the effort and the adventure and the sheer guts of the blokes that drove these things down over the sea ice deserved for that muskeg to be sat on its rock pinnacle, where it was sitting anyway, and left alone as a monument. So they started taking it to bits because it was a mechanical thing. You know, they didn't understand. It was a mechanical thing, and they started ripping it to bits and shipping the bits out. Now, that should be left there. It doesn't matter. It'll last longer than the hut, probably. And the effort that went into getting that machine down there was worthy of it being preserved. And I always felt bad about that. They'd done it by the time I learnt about it.
Eventually, you were offered a more regular, permanent post with Bass. I'm wondering how that occurred, how that came about.
After I finished my third winter, I was in Stanley, and I got the call to come and speak to John Borden, and he was living in the doctor's cabin at the time on the Bransfield, and he sort of stunned me rigid by saying, you know, do you want a job? I said, yes, because I had no firm plans. I was going to do a short trip through Argentina and back up through to Montevideo at that time. And, you know, that was accommodated. I went back. I got back to UK and phoned Bass, and they said, oh, when can you start? I said, next week. I think it was Bill Sloan I was talking to. I said, oh, what about next week? He was like, but I think they expected me to say, you know, oh, about 2 months' time or 3 months' time. Would that be convenient? But I wasn't doing anything. I just said, you know, next week, let's go. So I started the next week.
And what was the job description, John?
I was called a logistics officer.
Which means?
It means supplying spares, goods, services, and making sure it gets there. But that encompassed everything. It wasn't... Logistics officer dealt with, let's say, food and cooking and catering supplies and domestic supplies, everything you might need to live for a year, you know, comfort-wise. It might be all the radios and that part of it. It would be all the electrical supplies, it'd be engineering supplies, generators, vehicles, aircraft. It could be everything. It was a bit more than just saying a logistics officer. You know, you weren't just supplying things to be there on time. You were generating the need for them by what you saw. You were perhaps inventing the solution that was needed and seeing it through as well. So you were acting part as an engineer as well as being a person that bought supplies.
So this would be 1970?
74. Late 74.
Did you have budgetary restrictions? Were you...
We had a budget, yeah.
Yeah, was it generous or severe?
It was pretty generous. The second year, I think it wasn't quite so generous. I was asking people down south if they could do without if they had a small box of screws instead of a big box of screws. It was that silly. And suddenly the budget went chonk.
Do you know why?
Oh, change of government, I think. Simple as that. Certain governments were very kind to us and other governments weren't. I think it probably remains true to this day.
Mm. Was it, having been at the coalface, how did you feel about an office job back at Bass, back at HQ?
I felt... I can't say honoured, but I felt flattered to be offered a job that I might perhaps have something to offer them. I'd always been the same as everybody else that was down there. You'd criticise them like clappers. Like, man, they don't understand and this and that and the other. When the boot's on the other foot, it's completely different. It is completely different. You're juggling about a dozen balls at once to try and keep everything going. People down south consider that you've got nothing else to do but sit there and pander to all their whims. But if there's five bases going or something, and there's five people, ten people perhaps thinking that, and you're trying to juggle it all at once.
How streamlined was the operation at that point? Because the legends go back quite a long way with... Basic good order, theodolites and get stovepipes instead, and ask for a chainsaw and get an outboard motor.
Well, it's quite possible.
Was that still happening when you took over?
No, not to any great extent. The indent, unless you've seen it, you probably won't understand the indent system. It was a list of supplies, and it also formed a stock list, and everything was numbered. And you had three columns on the right. You had column one was the stock you should hold after relief. The second column was the stock you actually held, and the third column was the stock that you wanted to order. And you had to understand that if you didn't order anything, you were saying you had enough for 2 years. So you'd get all these lists come through, but the list didn't match up with the lines and the boxes. They were all before photocopying. Hmm. What was it called? I don't
know. Xerox, Ronio.
Perhaps Ronio.
Gestetner?
Gestetner, maybe. But all the lines were all... But you could interpret one box as one way or the other. And it was hopeless. Photocopying was common then, but they still kept on in these awful forms.
Carbon paper. Do you mean carbon paper?
No, it wasn't carbon paper. No, they had to produce these in three copies of these every year. Anyway, the whole thing was a muddle. The descriptions were sometimes unintelligible. You didn't know which bit to pick up to count because the descriptions were so loose. So that took a lot of tightening up, rewriting all these things so they were intelligible. And
so you were improving the system?
Improving the system in that way. Mm. But it's still an ancient system. It's all computerised now. Mm. It's all so easy. It wasn't then.
Did that spell the end of your trip south, or were you still going down in the summer?
I was still going down in the summer.
Every summer?
Pretty well to start with, yeah. Go down every summer. When I first joined, you went down for all the summer. You went down for the whole summer season. I mean, you might fly down to Montevideo or something to pick the ship up, so you missed 3 weeks. But you were down for the whole summer season. And I think I spent, on one occasion, I spent 100 days on the ship and only 9 days at bases doing anything meaningful. Because you were sitting there, you were just travelling around.
Mm.
It's hopeless. So you felt you were sitting there doing nothing. So we changed it after that, and we did half seasons. You did an early season, early half of the season, then a late half of the season. And
you occasionally, did 7 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did early, late, and occasionally you'd get a year or a summer off. You didn't go down. I can't think of many of those. It was much easier to achieve. It was due to the improvement of air service, firstly through Argentina. You fly to Buenos Aires, then to Comodoro Rivadavia, then across to Stanley, if you were lucky. That was before the invasion. Then after that, you were down to through Ascension and straight down to Falkland Islands.
So were you being flown in by the Argentinian Air Force?
Yes.
How was that?
Horrific.
How do you mean?
They were, of course, training flights. It was supposed to be a cooperative transport system between the Falklands and Argentina. But of course, they were using it for training to find their way to the Falklands.
Even 7 or 8 years ahead of the conflict.
Oh yeah, they were getting their pilots well versed in where it was.
Did you suspect that at the time? Did you?
Yes, yeah.
You did. So you spotted the conflict coming, did you?
No, I wouldn't say we spotted the conflict coming, but, I mean, I would have hoped the RAF would do things like that as well. I mean, it was a golden opportunity for them. You know? Yes, anybody would do it. Anyway, we flew with them, Fokker F-27s, off from Comodoro Rivadavia, head towards the Falklands, perhaps be 20 minutes out, and the weather would be unsuitable for landing, so you turn around and come back. Didn't matter to them, they knew where they were, they knew what they were doing. Very frustrating for us. And, of course, they were all a bit gung-ho, and coming back into Comodoro, they beat the desert up. And I've seen the dust whipped up by the wingtip over the desert. You know, and you think, God, what are these people up to? You know, they they're really a bit gung ho. These boys.
There were some fairly big projects going on at that time whilst you were in charge of logistics. One was the rebuild and the extension of Rotherhithe.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in charge of logistics. I did engineering logistics.
Right. So were you at all involved in supplying the bases or the new work to be done at bases, extensions and Alley 4?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for engineering supplies and engineering, some engineering design, yes. Yeah. I was in... I was in charge of very much at the time, but contributed to all that.
So you were going down there to see what was happening at Rotherhithe and Halley to...
Yes.
As part of your...
Yeah, well, when Halley 4 was built, I was doing the vehicle work at the time. I was doing the transport backwards and forwards and the site vehicles, stuff like that, which kept me busy. Mm.
Did you get to any of the foreign bases?
No, not much. Had a very short visit to the Russian base on King George Island. Same with the Chilean base. Just moments only, because I didn't have that much time. I've been to Palma once or twice, three or four times, actually.
Well, the cultural differences between the Americans and the British approach?
Completely different. When we were down there with dried meats and hardly had a freezer with anything in it, they had 26 different flavours of ice cream and tins of lobster tails and steaks and God knows what. And unbelievable difference. But I'm afraid but we've moved in exactly the same direction as they have. Yeah. Well, they had comfortable accommodation, warm, not that ours was warm or dry, but warm, dry individual rooms, large recreation facilities, all sorts of things that we never dreamed about.
Is that because they were just better funded by their own government?
I think their efforts stemmed from military experience, and that's what their military personnel would have expected, and that's what they got down there. Mm. You know, they'd have had a lawnmower if they indented for one.
If there'd been a lawn.
Yeah. I think they got one, actually.
You mentioned passing... dropping in at the German base on the Filchner ice shelf. I hadn't realised that there was a German base.
Yes, there was a German base on legs on the Filchner ice shelf. And on a flight back from Halley to Rotherhithe, just dropped in there one day. There was something to unload and leave in their base. Landed there and went onto the base. And, you know, I was quite surprised. It was well done. It was quite light. There wasn't that much on top of it. And the legs were adequate, but quite flimsy, I thought.
Was it staffed?
Oh, no. It was unmanned at the time. You know, we left whatever we had to leave and came away. You know, and they engaged the same people that designed that to design the Halley 5 base.
So you were seeing a prototype of Halley 5?
I was seeing what people thought was, people in Bass thought was worthwhile copying, and asking the people that had the experience of building it, designing it and building it, to design Halley 5, which was vastly more sizable, complex base. I mean, Filchner was a field hut on legs, several legs. It wasn't very sophisticated.
But did you tend to, having been there, did you tend to agree that it was a way forward for Halley to adopt those?
Yes, I was very pleased when they chose a base on legs. I think we were naive. I don't know who's going to hear this, but we were extremely naive in engaging the designers that we did, who came across and spoke to us. And as has happened before, I've noticed, we sat there and we unloaded all our experience to them, all our knowledge, you know, our experience of living in the Antarctic and what you could build and how you could do it and what you could do on snow and the rest of it. And we unloaded it to them. And then they sold it back to us. They sold it back to us. Except they put all the mathematics together to, you know, prove it, that it was fine. Because we operated on gut principles a lot of the time. We weren't at that scale anyway. But it's happened before. We've unloaded all our personal and corporate knowledge to these people about building in the Antarctic. And they turn around and write a report, and the hierarchy go, "Oh, this is fantastic." Aren't they good? Yeah, of course they're good. We bloody well told them everything they know. They knew nothing before they spoke to us. It's very annoying. But the management wouldn't have believed us.
Mm.
They had to pay a consultant a lot of money to tell them exactly the same thing, and then they believed it.
There were a couple of trips, if not perhaps longer period of time, on South Georgia towards the end of your career.
Hmm.
What was the reason for doing that?
South Georgia was going to be taken over from the Army. The Army wanted out, obviously, because presumably the military threat had disappeared. And there was a viable research need for the fisheries, because various nations were in there scooping things up, and they needed to do fisheries research to find out what was sustainable and what they were catching and all the rest of it. And to do that, the army had left the place in a shambles, as armies usually do. Anything mechanical they'd wrecked. So there was a new base needed, and towards the end I was involved in the specification and, to some extent, the design of it and the layout of it. Went down the following year while they built it, and that was very satisfying. Very good contractor, very rewarding. And the year after that, when it had been finished and there was just some snagging going on, I was down there as base engineer, just to see it into service, really. And that was it. That was when I finished. And South Georgia is the most gorgeous place you can ever visit.
How do you mean?
Oh, it's subtropical Antarctica, if you like. It's lush. At certain times of year, it's lush, but it's still sub-Antarctic. tremendous amount of wildlife, very scenic, a lot of history. A lot of people stop there on their way south and on the way back. And these places still exist. The actual whaling stations at that time all existed. I mean, Gripvickens has now been cleared, I understand. But you could walk around all these huge, steam-driven industrial complexes and just wonder how they got it all there, made it all work, and made a profit out of it. And I'm afraid the things that suffered were the whales. The whales paid for every last cent of the whole thing. And, I mean, they still haven't recovered. I mean, you can feel for it, because you walk along the beaches, there's whale skulls and bones and bits and pieces. And when the contractors were at South Georgia, they had to run a new freshwater pipe round from the whaling station, the dam above the whaling station. Near the whaling station, they dug. They were digging in a bit beside the road and dug up lumps of whale blubber, chunks, you know, just rubbishy stuff that had been ploughed in to build the land up a bit. There's whale blubber in it. And there had been no activity, whaling-wise, since, I don't know, 1966 or 67. So it must have been in there for getting on for 40 years, underground. And when it was dug up, the seagulls started eating it immediately. But stuff like that, it just... amazing.
Did you, this is a popular question, most of us like answering this one. Did you have any scary moments whilst you were down there?
Yes, well, apart from deception.
Well, yes, we've discussed that one already. It's the scariest of all doubts. Were there any other ones?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned it, but there was a... Adelaide was a dreadful place to unload. We lost a muskeg there once, and I was involved in that, unfortunately, and it was entirely due to the swell and an excess of zeal on our part, which didn't pay off.
How do you mean? What happened to the muskeg?
Oh, it tipped out the boat and was lost, unfortunately. There you are.
And the because of zeal?
Well, we wanted to get it ashore and get on with the push the unloading forward, and it was a nice calm evening, and by the time it got to the shore it wasn't quite so calm because it was open to the west, and in those days the sea ice was starting to disappear quite early. You got full Pacific swells coming in, and huge swells run over the jetty sometimes. On this occasion, it was calm. But when it came to bring it up alongside, it wasn't calm. And it all went wrong. I was always sorry about that one. But the other one was, we were in Terror, the open boat belonging to Bransfield, in Terror, and... Stuart Lawrence was in charge of it, and we came up to Adelaide Jetty and a huge swell came in and it lifted us way above the jetty and dumped us on top of the generator shed rocks, and we were sat in a big open wooden boat, motorboat, and the sea was 15 feet down. We could have stepped out and, but you would never be quick enough, and Stuart Lawrence shouted out, "Everybody stay in the boat." The next swell came in, picked it up, and put it back exactly where it was before, and we pulled up alongside the jetty. Absolutely incredible. It just so happened. It should have tipped over. It should have done all sorts of things. But it just, it worked out beautifully. Luck again.
Was he right? Was Stuart Lawrence right to say stay in the boat?
Yes. Yeah.
What? Well, if you hadn't done, what would have?
Well, you'd have been stranded out on the rocks as the swell came up. You know.
Unprotected.
Unprotected. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the boat, the boat was going to float one way or another. It's a big boat, big motorboat. It's tough as old boots.
There are a couple of incidents involving the Bransfield. So there was a story, of course, of the ice cliff falling in at Halley onto the Bransfield.
Yes.
Was that the incident that you witnessed?
Oh, yeah, I was on board. I'd gone to bed.
Tell me the story. You'd gone to bed?
I'd just gone to bed, yeah. We'd all come off shift, down to the ship, across that piece of ice cliff on a gangplank onto one of the upper decks and came down, got a meal, had a wash or whatever it is, and went to bed.
This was during relief, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Gone to bed, just got into bed, sort of... But there was the most enormous bang, wallop, and the ship tipped over at an enormous angle, and you could feel it shoot sideways. It was obvious, probably obvious what had happened. But the person that was in the cabin with me jumped out of bed, shot one way, shot the other, shot one way, shot the other, and then out the door. I was laid in the moat looking at him. And, you know, he panicked a bit. Perhaps he was right, I don't know. But, I mean, nothing happened. I was waiting to see what happened, whether the ship came back up again. The ship actually stayed quite well heeled over, and we spent the rest of that evening levering and chucking boulders of ice off the side of the ship. And it had smashed all the rail down, the rest of it. But, it could have been much more serious. I think one cabin had a window stove in. And that was about the extent of it. And the foredeck rail was squashed. There could have been somebody on the deck, and they'd have been completely squashed.
Well, there almost was, wasn't there? Wasn't it shortly after the end of the day's work that it happened?
Yeah. I mean, just could have been moments, yeah. Just so happened, but the engine started remarkably quickly. It happened, and I think people jumped down the engine room ladders without touching them, and it was going because it smashed all the mooring ropes.
So it was cast adrift.
Yes.
And the reason why it was listing so badly was because the weight of ice on one side of the deck.
Yeah.
Were there lessons to be learned from that?
Yes, I think we were chancing. I'm no expert, of course, but I think we were chancing around. We had no other option because the sea ice, there was no sea ice to unload on. In a bay with a nice ramp at the back of it that you could drive up. Mm-hmm. And the ship is relatively safe, moored up on sea ice, and the cliffs are well away. And a nice little ramp at the back and get up onto the ice and away. There wasn't one. It was just that time where sea ice and ramps were hard to find. So... they did what they had to do and moored up on the ice cliff. Picked the best bit they could, but it fell down.
Right in thinking that you also were around when the Bransfield got grounded at Rothera?
Oh, on the way to Rothera, yeah. Crumbs.
What happened there?
Going up inside of Jenny Island... there's quite a lot of islets and bits and pieces out there. They weren't going very particularly fast, but inside of Jenny, rather nice. Nice little trip through there. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I remember standing there with a cup of coffee and a saucer, and suddenly we were thrown forward somewhat. I thought, oh, that's not a piece of ice. There's a definite feeling between a piece of ice being hit and being shoved out of the way and hitting something that doesn't get shoved out of the way. And that was it. We went up this rock and got stuck for a little while. I did quite a lot of damage.
Again, you know what happened? What went wrong? What happened?
No, I've no idea.
How was it resolved? How did they get the boat off again?
It managed to wriggle itself off after a while. Maybe the tide came in and helped it a bit. But, I think there were some fair gouges out of the side of it. But, I think it's probably one of these semi-submerged rocks that had perhaps never been charted properly, or even charted at all.
So you had a number of close calls, really, or scenarios which could have been a lot, lot worse. Were you constantly aware that the Antarctic was a dangerous place?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. I mean, you might not think it's particularly dangerous, but it could turn around and catch you out so very easily. Mm. You know what? Go on a boat trip or something and don't take all the... Doesn't happen these days. People take what they're instructed to take. But in our days, you could have travelled out there in a swimsuit if you wanted to. You didn't, obviously, but you took what you thought was good. But a lot of the stuff was Kapok life jackets and stuff like that, which are fairly blooming useless. But we had them. Took them but didn't wear them. Anything could have happened. We were around in small boats. One day we were out from Stonington in a large plastic boat. There was about five of us in there, two seagull outboards on the back, and a seal passed us. We were motoring along quite happily, but a seal passed us, swimming as fast as it could, looking over its shoulder. So we all thought, oh, look behind us, and there's a big black fin scything through the water behind us. And it wasn't bothered by us. It was after that seal. It was a killer whale after the seal. Who knows what would happen if it decided that the contents of the boat were interesting. It didn't. We thought, oh, gosh, that's interesting. We'll go home now.
The various things you were able to achieve in your years with Bass, what stands out as the things you're perhaps most proud of or satisfied with?
Satisfied, yeah.
I mean, you were instrumental in bringing the Skidoo into regular use, weren't you?
Yes. When Dick Laws took over, he sort of grilled everybody as to what they thought should the future was, if you like. He came down to bases and visited them, and fair dues to him, he gave everyone a hearing. And he asked me about transport, and I told him what I thought about Skidoos. The change came fairly soon after. Whether I influenced him or had a small part in influencing him, maybe. Obviously other people were saying perhaps quite similar things. And motorised transport came in fairly quickly after that. Mm. And
did you have a significant contribution to the design of the Halley rebuilds?
Not particularly on Halley 4. I took part in Halley 3, the Armco base, as a FID. I was on my way to Stonington and got sent via Halley. You know, I knew it was going to happen, to take part in the rebuild, which was very interesting. So I'd never been to Halley before. Halley 4, I was more involved with the transport and the site plant the cranes and the snowblower and bits and pieces like that that we were needing. Halley 5, I was involved in the design, specification and design, and it was all done through a German company. The people that had built this small platform on the Filchner Shelf. And, well, we went with it, and it's still standing.
Were there particular bits of Halley 5 that you had an influence over?
I did suggest the tunnels. They were wanting to get power and heating to the Met building. So I suggested that, as Halley 3 had quite a lot of success, the big Armco wasn't particularly good, but the little tiny Armco interlinking tunnels seemed to withstand almost anything. So I suggested a long tunnel with pipes and cables running down it, and as far as I know, it's still there. Interestingly, when it was built, it was arrow straight. It was like looking down a rifle barrel. After 2 years, you couldn't quite see down it because of the ice at either end, or the ice over the length that it had moved, and the tunnel had bent. And it's carrying on doing that, I guess. And all the pipes and cables and wires that go down it.
Which is what was intended, I presume.
I don't think they perhaps realised it was going to move quite so much. There's certainly no flexible joints put in the middle of it, or in every few metres, which would have been the way to do it. Not only is it bending, but it's dipping in places. So it's like that. Very strange. But it seems to have survived. And there was a melt tank. The original melt tanks were Braithwaite tanks. Not particularly successful. So we had another one, which was a big stainless, 11 cubic metre stainless tank, and that's the one that's now 100 feet down. And that is, I don't know what the silo is, we call it a silo that it was sat in. It's made out of Braithwaite panels, and it's the only Braithwaite structure that's circular. All the rest are square cubes because of the panels. This one was made circular, 16 panels circular with some spacer plates, angled spacer plates. And it appears to work a treat because circular things resist pressure much better than flat things. And the tank sat in there, and every 3 metres there was a floor that went in. The idea was you could store things in there if you wanted to, but essentially the floor stiffened up the whole structure. That was my idea. The tank was my design. The idea of a circular Braithwaite was mine. It sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet.
No, no, no.
Unless I say so, there's other people that will say it's theirs and have done.
It's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of specific detail questions from Alan Weirden.
Oh, yeah.
Why did Bass buy the Kempsave stoves for so many years?
I was going to come to that. I was going to say, I was going to ask you if you'd ask me if there was anything I regretted.
Ah, is there anything you regretted,
and
John?
That was going to be one of them. The Kempsave stove was a very big mistake.
Why?
We wanted an oil-fired stove, cooking stove, that wasn't an Aga. If you've any experience of cooking with an Aga, they start off red hot in the morning and they lose the heat gradually throughout the day. And if you've got to cook a large meal for 25-30 people or so, it's a storage heater, a storage stove. It stores heat, and you only got to lift those lids a few times and the heat starts disappearing. By the time you get to evening meal time, the blasted thing's cold. and you wait for ages for it to work. So we got an oil-fired, fan-blown cooker, marine cooker. It was a pucker marine cooker, made for trawlers and all sorts of things like that. On the face of it, fantastic. In practice, absolutely dreadful.
Because?
I don't know. As I say, on the face of it, it should have worked beautifully. In practice, they turned out to be quite a low performance, absolutely stinking things. No good at all. And before we learnt the lesson, we'd installed one at Halley as well. So I'm sorry about those.
you had other successes with stoves, though. There was a gas stove which went to Halley 5, which you'd organised, and that apparently was very successful.
That's to replace the Kempsife, which I'm so embarrassed about. Yes, I think that's been... Nobody's ever come back and said, oh, it's a load of rubbish and it's blown up. I probably oversupplied the amount of gas. I think it probably supplied probably twice as much as they needed. But nobody had any idea anyway, so better to supply twice as much than only half as much as they needed. Yeah, it was propane cylinders, 47 kilogram cylinders, about 60 of them a year. Just like you'd supply in the UK, and a commercial catering six burner stove, grill, a separate grill. I think it was about it to start with. And I had to heat the cabinet that cylinder sat in up on the platform, because minus 50 or so, minus 40, the minus 40 propane hides in the bottom of the cylinder and won't come out. It doesn't cooperate at all. So they had to go into a heated cabinet, and that was a lovely bit of work by somebody. Drew up what I wanted. They made it. It's gorgeous, beautifully done. And that's heated off the platform's hot water system, just to give it a little tiny bit of heat to vaporise the gas. I think it's worked. I've never had any feedback to say it hasn't worked.
Tell me about the Polar Medal. Was it a complete shock?
Yes, it was. I had no idea. I didn't think anything I'd done would deserve it, to be honest. You know,
you went to get it.
Yes.
How was that day? What were you wearing?
Oh, I did the full thing the first time.
What's that?
Oh, with the top hat and the
morning suit
and the stripy trousers and the gloves. I mean, the hat and the gloves you never wear. You just hand them in. And then stand these horribly baggy trousers and the rest of it. But I did it.
Was it the Queen or...?
Yes, it was. First, yes.
How was it?
That's fine. The only regret I had is the Polar Medal is so low in stature, in status, that you go in at the end and you spend all your time sitting in the anteroom waiting while everybody else goes in order of preference or merit or whatever it is. And you're left... You don't see any of the ceremony at all. You do your bit, and then it's all over. I think there was one person behind me, and that was some poor army girl that had got some sort of army medal that just happened to be, you know, a shade lower than the Polar Medal. And that was me, and then that was her. She was the last one. I never saw any of the ceremony.
And then he got the clasp.
Yes.
Another top hat?
No, I lounge suited it this time. I'd done the first one, thanks.
Did anybody explain to you why you'd been given A, the Polar Medal, and B, the clasp?
No, I didn't expect that at all. I didn't expect it. I'm very grateful, but I didn't expect it. I didn't feel I'd done anything special to deserve that bit. not going to send it back. But it was quite an interesting ceremony, actually, because I was the only one that had a clasp to anything. And all these people were briefed for the ceremony and the rest of it. And I think, what's the chap's name that does it? Famous. I had his name a little while ago. He called out my name. He said, "All this applies to except John Newman." "What have I done?" He said, "You will be presented, instead of having a medal hung on you, you will be presented with a case opened with the clasp in it." Ah, yeah. So that was different. Again, it was at the end. But I was in that group of people, and out of the 50 or 60 people, one person came out of the crowd and sort of wandered up to me and said, "Oh, it's a fair do, this, isn't it?" He said, "I'm from Tenby. I've been working on lifeboats for 25 years. I said, "You're from Tenby? You know, must know the Croxfords then." Two of the brothers were on the Bisco when I went down. I said, "You must know the Croxfords then." He said, "Know the Croxford? I am a Croxford." He was a cousin of these two. Just in, you know, what a coincidence that out of that crowd, one person should come up and speak to me. And that was it. He was a cousin of two chaps on the Bisco.
You said at the very beginning that the last few years of red tape and bureaucracy at Bath rather tainted your experience, and you left, you took early retirement.
Yes.
Has that clouded the whole of the Antarctic experience, or
oh, no.
Does it do the early years still shine for you?
No, all the years, all the years shine. Being down south is the jewel. Being back in Cambridge, especially towards the end, was definitely not the jewel. And you worked back there to go down there, down to the Antarctic. You didn't work in Cambridge for the sake of Cambridge. That was a no-no. Quite a few people that, technical people that joined, left fairly quickly. A few of them. And you felt that they were looking for perhaps not the same things that we were looking for. They were looking for a career, UK-based, and it wasn't offered to them as they expected, and they hopped it fairly quickly. Yeah.
We'll leave it there, John. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, right.
Was there something else that was to burble out?
No, I wanted to just say that none of what happened and all the work that was achieved or whatever, none of it would have been possible without a lot of the people back in Cambridge that felt and worked the same way together. There's Al Smith, who was head of the section, Andy Speary in vehicles, Jerry Nicholson for aeroplanes, the electricians that I worked with was Tony Escott, Jim Gorman, and Mark Dunn. They were all fantastic support. Barry Peters, I think you've met him on the communications side. Steve Cannon on the building side. They all were so helpful. And if it wasn't for people like that, that were trying to do the same thing as you, that were just as busy as you, and you asked a favour of them, and they set aside time to accommodate you, nothing would have worked without people like that being on the same side. And I'm grateful to them forever.